can get even the best man to sometimes want to run away from the whole thing and say, "Oh, let's find a different world, a different universe somewhere, a pleasant place without all of these big problems." Because as it stands right now, there's no way out. I mean, we are in an end game, and Lynn is emphasizing this again and again and again, that what we're experiencing now is not just a rerun of the crisis we've seen over the last 30, 40 years, but the global system is coming down. The British are totally aware of this, and they're totally dedicated to make sure that they will not lose power, that they will not lose their grip on the world because of this crisis. And if that means that the whole human race has to go to hell, so be it, because they would rather be masters in hell than non-masters in heaven. That's the character of Satan, that's the character of the British. And if we stick to the axioms, if everybody behaves like they used to behave, and if everybody thinks like they used to think, and make decisions like they've been used to making them, then there is no way out of this crisis. Then we are on the way straight to hell. Then we probably will have in a decade or two, maybe 500 million people left on Earth in a very precarious situation. But on the other side, this crisis puts the things in what you say on the point that there's only one way we avoid that, and that is by doing what we human beings are actually here to do, and that is to change the rules of the game. This is the unique quality we human beings have. Everything else in the I mean, if we look at this, we Linda referenced it also yesterday, Vernadsky, this great Russian scientist, who was a scientist in many different fields, in geology, in physics, in chemistry, in you name it. And he studied began studying, so to speak, everything he could get hold of geological footprints of what has been going on this planet, and basically showed that you can divide what has been going on in different groupings with very distinct characteristics. That when you begin to look at rocks and fossils and activities also that's going on the planet, you very quickly discover that there is processes that have to do with that there are rocks and things that you see that have to do with non-life, the abiotic domain, you can call it, but where you have simply rocks that are lying there and doing nothing. And then you also have fossils, you have things like what do you call chalk, you have coal, you have many different remnants on the surface of the earth which are there due to the activity of living organisms. And when you begin to investigate it further, you see that there's some very distinct, there's a marked difference between what you can call the abiotic domain or the dead things, but the abiotic domain, and then everything that relates to the biotic domain that has to do with biology, that has to do with living processes. As you divide it up and you go around and you begin to dig around in Earth and investigate things, you also find out Vernadsky says, that actually the biology, the living processes on the planet Earth dominate the non-living processes. That is, that it is possible at some point when the Earth was created that there was not much life here, it was all dead things, we don't know. But even if that might have been the case, at some point life appeared, and as soon as life appeared, it began to gobble up, eat up the dead things, the rocks, all these dead molecules and what you have, and began to transform them, began to incorporate them in their living activities. In such a way that over time, even though you first had this maybe a fairly dead planet with a huge mass, then as time went by, you see that life, the living processes, simply reorganize the planet and takes over more and more. And it's actually so that if you physically measure it, if you say, okay, how much left, how much biology and how much remnants from biological processes do we have here on Earth, then you'll see that this mass grows, and it grows relative to the non-living. But then Vernadsky says that's not the end of the story, because exactly the same kind of difference as you see this marked difference between non-living and living organisms, then you also see a marked difference between living organisms and products of human beings, products of cognitive processes. And that in the same way as biology very quickly took the upper hand on the planet and dominates non-life totally, in the same way we see that man, who has a very short existence here on the planet in geological terms, we're talking about 4.7 billion years or something like that, and man was here a very short time of that. Even though that's the case, in this extremely short time, man begins to totally dominate both the non-life sphere, the abiotic domain, and the living organisms, the biotic domain. And we are, in a certain sense, just in the beginning of this. I mean, and if you just look over the last couple of hundred years, this has actually been a marked difference in how much you recognize the human activity on the planet Earth. I mean, already now, I mean, probably most of you have seen these pictures taken from space of Earth at night, where you see Western Europe, you have a lot of light, you see Africa, where there's some lights on the coast, but there's a lot of very dark areas. You see the Trans-Siberian Railroad, where you see lights along, and so on. And this is the reflection. This is like you sit out in space and you say, hey, what's that? What's that on Earth? There's something looking different. Ah, it's cognition that has begun to take its hold there. We are this cognitive power. Animals are forced to live by the rules and by the order set by nature. If you are rabbits, then you can eat what nature will provide for you. And if there's not enough food, some of the rabbits die. If it's a cold winter, more of the rabbits die. And nature regulates the population of rabbits. And that's how it is to be a rabbit. You are a total slave of, on the one side, the rules set from the outside, and on the other side, the drifter,
drives,
the built-in drives and habits that you have as an animal species. And then sometimes you can grow, sometimes you can decrease. It's all part of nature's game. Man uniquely has this capacity of saying, no, we don't accept that. We cannot accept that we are now going to have a global food crisis. There's not enough food. Therefore, 100 million people or 1 billion people have to die. We uniquely have this capacity of saying, let's change the rules of the game. And in exactly the same way, Vanatsky then shows that you had this domination of the living organisms over the non-living organisms. In exactly the same way, we are beginning to see how man, as through his cognitive powers and as a representative of cognition in the universe, is dominating both the non-living and the living domain here on Earth. And we do this both in terms of mass, that is, if you measure how much of Earth's activities are actually influenced by man's cognitive powers, then you'll see also in terms of physical mass it increases. More and more parts of nature are influenced by decisions we have made. I mean, both in taking animals from nature and domesticating them, having cows, having pigs, having all that kind of stuff, by producing and refining better types of grain, and so on and so forth. We transform nature. But it's also its mass, but it's also over time, all the time, we transform the part of the universe where we are in terms of quality. That is, it's not just change, it's actually an improvement. And just like we see in animals, the lack of ability to change the rules of the game. So if for some reason the natural circumstances changes, then you'll see that animal species disappear. And in their place come other animal species that are suited to be in these new circumstances. So change does happen. But change does not happen within the animal species. Change happens within the biology as such, where species disappear and new are created. Only we, on the contrary, we change the surroundings. We remain, so to speak, the unchanged constant in one sense, by being a human being, by being the human species, and then change the surroundings. And this is a uniquely human quality, but this is also where we are caught right now, that if we do like most people tend to do, that is, that we, like animals in a certain sense, accept to be mental slaves, accept not to change ourselves and change the universe around us. Like we read yesterday with Schiller's description of this bread-learned scholar, somebody that studies books in order to get a job, get a career, get an income, get a position, get ahead in life, but refuses to be able to change his mind when he figures out that what he has learned is wrong and will not do what has to be done. then you are in a certain, you are a mental slave. And in this sense, you become, you are under the same rules as the animals. You are no longer a master of your destiny. Mankind is no longer a master of our destinies. We are just forced to suffer under the consequences of whatever will happen. So, how do we do it? How do we do what animals cannot do? How do we change the rules of the game? That's the key. And if you take it as an example, you can say, well, we run into a paradox. We run into a problem. We observe something that's a contradiction. It can be something in nature where our theory says one thing should happen, and then we see a totally different event, and then we say something is wrong here. There's a paradox. On the one side, we have what should happen according to the textbook. On the other side, then we have what we observe. They don't fit together. And if you're a student, you can be in school and you can make an experiment. Maybe you have a teacher that has said, now you do the following, you make this experiment. You go home and you make the experiment and you get the wrong result. So the question is, what do you do? Probably you repeat the experiment. What then if you get the wrong result again? Then you try to figure out, did I do something wrong here? And then you find out, no, you did nothing wrong. The textbook is wrong. Seemingly, you got this other result. And then, of course, then you have, as man, two different options. I mean, you can run screaming away. You can say, no. I don't go there. I must have made a mistake. You probably will do that the first time you make the experiment. And you correct the results so it fits the textbook. And you give it to the teacher, and the teacher is happy and he says, you passed the course. Or you say, here's the paradox. It doesn't fit. Something must be wrong. And you then say, well, maybe we have some wrong axioms here. Maybe there's something wrong in what we thought things was. That we took something for granted which was wrong, and therefore it doesn't fit. So you check your axioms and try to figure out, what could be wrong in the way we've been thinking about this, which creates this paradox, which creates this wrong result. And you can create, or you create a hypothesis, you say, but maybe we've just been stupid on this point. Maybe it's not like this. Maybe it's like in a totally different way. Maybe, like at one point, light was universally believed to be instantaneous. Light, it comes immediately. That's the way it is. Everybody knows that. You can see it. And then Ole Rømer, the Danish scientist, says, "No, that's not true. What he did was." He had this problem with the moons of Jupiter. Jupiter has moons, and these moons won't rotate round Jupiter. And at that time, they would have the problem that they would observe these moons of Jupiter, and you can observe when they go in behind Jupiter and when they come back out, when you can see them again. And it's like a clock, it's rotating around, and you can take the time. And then they would have this problem. And Ole Rømer, he was a Danish scientist. He was went from Denmark to Paris to be together with Leibniz and Huygens and others, study science. And it was down there he made these astronomical observations. And then they had this problem that when there was a long time you didn't see Jupiter, then when it turned up again, then the timing was wrong. Then the moon did not appear like they should. They were maybe 10 minutes off. And what Ole Rømer did was, he said, aha, but maybe this has something to do with something I suspected for a long time. Namely, that this idea that light is instantaneous, maybe that's wrong. Why should it be? Maybe light takes time. He said that light lyset tøver. Light hesitates. It's not, it's quick, but not that quick. And what so he had this paradox. He began to check the axioms, namely this idea that light is instantaneous. And then he created a hypothesis. He said, aha, so maybe this effect we observe, maybe this is due to the fact that light takes time. And when we watch Jupiter at one point out in the sky, we make our observations. Then for maybe 3-4 months we can't see Jupiter because it doesn't appear on the night sky. And then when it comes up again, it's in a different position relative to the Sun and relative to Earth. And because light takes time, then we get this delay. Now, then what you do if you have such a problem? You make a hypothesis. But then the problem, of course, is you made this hypothesis. How do you know if it's right or if it's wrong? How can you, should you go out and take a vote? Then it will always be wrong because everybody will see, no, 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 I read in the textbook, it's like this. You search on Wikipedia, no chance. So the only way you have to test whether your hypothesis is more correct than what everybody else believes and what you can see on Wikipedia is you have to make a physical experiment. There's no other way. And then you have to design a physical experiment in such a way that if the textbook, if the Wikipedia knowledge is true, you get one result. If your new hypothesis is true, you get a different result. And then you can see what was the better to predict the result of this event, my hypothesis or the present established beliefs of the time. Now what Ole Rømer did at the time, who had some guts, was that he wrote this up, and he says it's very simple, that soon Jupiter is going to disappear, and when it comes back, then the moons will be delayed by 13 minutes because of this. And then he shows, because this is the speed of time and this is the positions, and therefore this will be the effect,
the speed of light. Mm-hmm.
And then he wrote this up as a leaflet, and he distributed it not all over Paris, but in the scientific community. And everybody got ready to beat up Ole Rømer when Jupiter came back, and you would see what happened. But what happened was that Ole Rømer was right. What did that tell? That tell that probably he then was right about the speed of light. That light takes time. That didn't mean that everybody in Paris and the world said, "Great Ole Rømer, now we change our theories." Most people, of course, says there must be a mistake. There must be a mistake. And this, in a certain sense, it's the same thing that Lynn does all the time.
Do you know what experiment he did to figure out the speed of light?
Who?
Rømer.
Because you have earlier observations.
Oh, okay.
So
he based his hypothesis on that.
On the observations, yes.
I see, okay.
Yes. And Lynn does this all the time. I mean, he has a hypothesis. This is the state of affairs. This is how the financial system is. And people say, oh, that's your opinion. Lyndon LaRouche, you have your opinions, but I have 99 economics professors, including 5 that has won the Nobel Prize, and many that are working in Harvard and Sorbonne and all the prestigious things. So I choose to believe them. So LaRouche says, well, they're wrong. And this is why they're wrong. And this is what will happen. Like he did it in the July 27th webcast, and he says, now the thing is going to crash down. And 3 days later, the first banks begin to crash. So you make hypotheses, but somehow, in order to either to validate your hypothesis, you need a physical experiment. And in science, when you create a physical experiment, then it's many times difficult. It means that you have to construct new machinery in order to make the experiment. You want to observe an effect you can't just observe, so you have to build instruments to observe it. And you have the added benefit that what you built to observe it is new technology, which you then can use in the all parts of the economy. In human activity, in as such, our laboratory is physical economy. It is how is human beings surviving on this planet? That's, so to speak, the laboratory where we test out different ideas about how the world functions, how the universe functions. We have hypotheses. We make policies, and then we have a physical test, which is our economy. How does it work out? And just like we have today, we have this global food crisis. And then you will have people says, "Oh, but that's simple. We have a global food crisis because we have too many people." Simple. We have too many people that are eating too much. I mean, if there should be 1.4 million Chinese, 1.4 billion Chinese, then they'll have to stick with eating one meal a day. You know, if they want to have 2 or 3 meals, it's okay, but then they have to chop their population down to lower numbers. Or the Africans, or the South Americans, or in the end, also the Europeans and the Americans. So you have this paradox, so to speak, because you say we have this globalization policy, it's great, it's fantastic, but at the same time we now get food crisis and all of this. There you have your paradox. And then we are stuck with this situation. I mean, either you accept the paradox and you, like an animal, accept the consequences, or you change the axioms of the system. And in this case, changing the axioms of the systems will mean go back to national sovereignty, go back to the principle of the benefit of the other, not free trade, not buy cheap, sell dear, cheat the others and be rich, which is the British principle, and it always was, and it's openly they say this, buy cheap, sell dear. And they forgot to tell you that in order for you to buy cheap and sell dear, there's got to be somebody that is being cheated out there. So instead of this British system of global free trade, globalization they call it, you have to change the axioms, go back to a system of national sovereignty, the benefit of the other, of saying, how can I improve my conditions of life, how can we as a nation improve our conditions of life, and others too? Well, we do can by global development. We can that by putting man's cognition to work with changing the earth to be a more nice place for us human beings to do. Having better infrastructure, improve agriculture, build up industry, etc., etc., but also by snatching the parasites, by going after a city of London and these financial powers that are sucking out the life of mankind. So we have this, we have this in our in science. We have this principle. We develop science. We find a paradox. We make new hypotheses. We make physical experiments to test the validity of them. And we have this same principle applied in a different way in the whole human activity, and there the testing ground is physical economy. And as LaRouche then also has shown, this gives you a measuring rod, a very specific measuring rod, for knowing whether you're doing something good or you're doing something bad, namely what he calls the relative potential population density. That is, how many people are you able to feed on a certain area of land now and in the future? And not only that, but is this going up or is this going down? If you do the right, you can say that if you carry out policies, carry out changes in how we behave ourselves and how the Vernadsky, when he speaks about these things, he says this, he calls this the living organism all working together on the planet. He says this is the biosphere. And then he says, just like you have a biosphere, which is all the living activity as one dynamic whole, you also have a new sphere, which is all of our, the effects of our cognition and what we as a human civilization do. This is then the new sphere. And how the new sphere develops is then being tested by this measuring rod. If we are able to feed more people on a higher standard of living, then something is improving. Then we are improving the conditions of the new sphere. If we don't do that, then we observe that suddenly we are able to feed less people on a lower standard of living here on Earth. And this is what we've been seeing like in Africa over the last 25 years, that the ability to actually feed the population of having a certain living standard is going down, but not only in Africa. If you look at the living standard, this has been going on in the United States, this has been going on in most parts of the world for the last 25 years. So we have this measuring rod that tells us, so to speak, are we improving or are we progressing or are we
declining,
degressing or collapsing in how well we are able to take care of a growing population. And you could also say it in another way, this is also a measurement of our role in perfecting the universe or improving the universe as a whole. That is, that biology is a very beautiful thing which makes the universe much more beautiful than if you just had all those dead objects floating around there. It's a fantastic thing, and it's improving and improving and improving. And this, you then, when you begin to observe, because everybody that studies science learn in school that the most fundamental law is the second law of thermodynamics from Newton, which is that if you have a higher state of energy in one part of the universe and lower state of energy in another part of the universe, then this will all equal out. Then energy will flow from the higher state to the lower state, and you'll get a soup of it's all being the same. It's, I guess they call it heat death. But this heat death is, you learn in physics, the most fundamental law of nature. The universe, so to speak, is in a constant process of dying. And we observe this, and then we can begin to speculate how quickly the universe will be dying. And in the same way mankind is on Earth, they'll say by a mistake, by a random fluke, by something that just happened, probably unintended, but there was nobody to have an intention, so these things can go wrong. And it's therefore we have mankind, but it's only for a very short time, because then mankind, like everything else, will die. We have certain resources, but of course they run up, and then we die the heat death. Then that's it. And the problem, of course,
that's why we have the food crisis.
And that's why we have the food crisis. Limited raw materials. You can't keep growing.
Mm-mm.
There's limits to growth. We have to face it. We have to make sacrifices. We've been having it good, too good for too long. And here in Denmark, I mean, this is, of course, we know this for sure because we are Protestants. Even those that are not practicing Protestants, they only go to church maybe once a year for Christmas or something, they still get it in the culture that deep down we're all sinners. Deep down, you know, we all screw up. And we also know if something is good, then it's bound to be bad. Right? It seems good. It seems nice at the time. And then you pay the price later. Right? We know this. And the point is, if we study universe, it's not how the universe functions. On the contrary. And if we study biology, it's not like, you know, we began with these very, very fantastic this fantastic biology, and then it all fell apart. And then after some time, then you go from these very beautiful, you had a deer down there, you have birds, you have all of these things, but then they die the heat death, and then they dissolve, and over time you only have one-celled organisms left all over the universe. It doesn't work like that. On the contrary, there's this constant development that you either, if you have an organism, lo and behold, if you step outside for 10,000 years and come back, you'll see something that's an improved version. Always there's development, and the same thing we see also if we look on Earth. We put on some glasses of a longer historical span of time, like the Earth's total development over maybe 4.7 billion years, then we see that this development Vernetsky described, yes, there was a lot of rocks here of all different kinds, and it was very boring. But after some time, then biology took over, and maybe it was primitive to begin with, but it kept developing, kept experimenting, kept making new improved models. Sometimes it kind of went a little bit in the woods, like with the dinosaurs, you know, big body, small brain. Then you have to, you know, redo the experiment and try something better, which happened. And then you also had, again, in what is this very short time here in the end of the development here on Earth, you then have cognition, you have human beings. So what we observe is the totally opposite of what is taught as the fundamental rules of physics in the school, this idea of the second law of thermodynamics, or you can call it the dying of the universe. What we physically observe is, and what nature all the time proves by new physical experiments, is that we have a constant development. That instead of having entropy, this Newton's second law of thermodynamics also is called entropy, that everything gets entropic, it means it falls apart and spreads out to nothing. What we see is totally opposite. We see anti-entropy. Yes, we can see things, you know, we see something die, and once it's dead, an animal, then it dissolves. But the species as a whole don't die. And the same thing, we see many things fall apart. But if we look at the process as a whole, they only fall apart to pave the way for a greater and better development. So you have this specifically anti-entropic quality in the universe. It's as if there was this and in the old days you would say a natural drive for improvement. Today, with Prince Philip and the World Wildlife Foundation and this whole green ideology, people will say this crazy idea that we should always strive for things being better and better and having more people on a higher standard of living. What is that? But that is a living out of this totally fundamental principle of how the universe functions of anti-entropy. And for us human beings, I mean, we are have been given the position, so to speak, of we've been given cognition, which is totally unique. No animals has this. And if, I mean, there's been all of this fixation on the physical appearance of man, they, people say, you know, we look like monkeys. And Prince Philip for sure looked like a monkey. And some people definitely behave like monkeys. Go to Roskilde Festival and you'll see monkeys taking a mud bath. But despite that, the fact that you, sometimes we look and behave like monkeys, if we were monkeys, if we were, you know, the unique thing about man was that we had the opposable thumb, so we can grab things, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, he likes to grab things. Then the point is, we might be 10 million man monkeys on Earth. We would go around, we would pick the berries, we would eat things from dead animals, we find this and that, have a very primitive existence. If we were lucky, some of us might be 20 years of age. Most would die before they were 1 year old. But we are not. We are over 6 billion. And that is exactly because we have this fantastic creativity, this ability to change the rules of the game, to break, to change the axioms. And for us, right, for us, I mean, this is then the big question. Do you want to be a human being, or do you want to be an animal-like imitation of a human being? Do you want to be like a cogwheel, a tenure, in a greater machinery where you perform the functions that the machinery has thought out for you? Which is also basically what most people get trained to when they go to school these days. They're not supposed to think, they're not supposed to change the rules of the game, they're supposed to, you know, do the services in the spots you're appointed to. Whereas if we choose to be human beings, then our job is to change the rules of the game on behalf of the good, inducing a change for the good. Now, of course, the problem in this is that there seems to be a tendency when you stand in front of doing that and you can see something is wrong, and you might also have an idea of what should be done about it, especially you see yourself do something and you know you could do a lot better than that, you know you could have play a totally different role as a cognitive power in the universe, and then you don't just do it. You get scared. It's like Hamlet, that is not a stupid guy. He knows what's going on. He knows his father got killed by his father's brother. He knows the whole thing is going to hell. He knows he should do something about it. He has it all. He knows all of these things. But he's afraid. And even in this, in Hamlet, if you read the play, I don't have it here, he has different places where he presents this. He has one place where he says, "Damn, why am I living in such a rotten time? Why was my father killed by my father's brother? If I was living in a better time, I would be a very, very fine prince of Denmark." He says this. "I would be doing a great job. But because of these circumstances, I'm bound to be a tragedy." And in a quote, Linz likes it a lot. I don't like him know it by heart. Hamlet has this soliloquy where he basically goes through and says, well, yes, in order to get out of the mess, we have to change. I have to change. But I would rather bear the ills that I know than go into the unknown. So he's saying, yes, I know if I could change, there might be a way out, but if I change, then I get into something I don't know. I don't have the usual axioms. I don't have the system to hold on to. So I rather hold on to the ship, even though the ship is going down, because I feel at home on my ship. And this is also the issue of all tragedies, that you have a society. Like at Hamlet's time, you have an elite, you have a court. At the time, Kronborg, it's not a totally true story, but in Shakespeare's setting of it anyway. And in order for society, for this society to survive, in order for there to be a happy ending, which would not be an ending but a happy continuation, let's say that, instead of a sad ending, you will have to change. The axioms that people believe in will have to change. And if you don't, then you have the tragedy. And what the great tragedy writers like Schiller and Shakespeare and so do is that they show these tragedies on stage, show what is the consequences of you not being willing to change, in order for us to be induced to do what we know we should do, that is change, so there can be a happy continuation. Now, this is not something new. I mean, and this is also what we now in the basement crew they've been working on, because as some of you might have known, there was this guy, old Greek Heraclit, who had this saying: the only thing that is constant is change. And they had all of these proverbs: you can never walk into the same river twice. Because everything changes. Our bodies changes. We never have the same body 2 days in a row. That's a fact. So everything changes. And therefore the question is, what do we then know for sure? And that's then the question of science. Euclid, as you might have seen, Lynn is not a great fan of Euclid. He calls him a fraud, he calls him a faker, he probably also and Euclid has played a great negative role in science. Now the problem with Euclid, I don't know how many of you have actually ever heard of Euclid or seen something, but in former times when you studied science or mathematics or these things, the first thing you would do was you would get these 13 books, I think it is, of Euclid that you would work through. It's small books. But anyway, and this would be how do you, it would begin with some postulates and axioms and preconditions, and then it would end up with the constructions of the five Platonic solids. Okay? And all the measurements of the five Platonic solids. What are the ratios? What are this? What are that? And then what is done in Euclid is basically it all begins by saying, well, there's certain things we take for granted. Like a point is something without extension. A line is the shortest distance between two points, and it has no breadth. No, not breadth.
Width.
No, ingen bredde. And so on and so on. You have a circle is a line that is equidistant from all the way around from a point. He has some funny definition of it. So you begin the whole thing with having all of these he uses the expression axioms and postulates and general notions. And these are all things which you don't prove. It's not like you just say this is how it is. This is the rules of the game. And if you accept these rules, if you accept that we have these points and these lines and we have circles and we have this playground, then we can do certain things. And then Euclid then begins building the world of his geometry. I mean, you can make a triangle, right? An equidistant triangle, like we do with these things. And then he describes how you can do it and prove, according to the axioms and postulates that he made in the beginning, that this construct, according to this, this construction of a triangle follows the rules that he laid out in the beginning. And then you can begin to make all kinds of constructions. You can make squares, you can make pentagons, you can make pentagons in a circle, you can make pentagons outside a circle, and you build a whole universe. And the way you prove that these things are valid and real is by referencing back to the axioms you laid out in the beginning. Then you can say, if you can prove that what you just said fits the axioms you laid out in the beginning, then you can end with the famous QED, quod et demonstrandum. Mm-hmm. Thereby, that has been proven. It is so. And what you've proven, you can then use for other things, to prove new things. And you built, you can say, in the bottom, you have these axioms, a small group of axioms, and then you can build a bigger and bigger tree on top of it that grows in all different directions. Now, what Riemann did in his 1854 habilitation dissertation that Lynn references to, was that Riemann, he basically said that from all this time, from Euclid to modern times, we have all learned this and worked with this system, but people have not really raised the question, what about these axioms? And in order for this to be really true, we can't begin by having arbitrary axioms. We have instead to have principles that we can prove to be true in the physical universe. And this is why Lynn loves Riemann so much. And Riemann also ends by, he has a lot of interesting stuff there, and then he ends by saying that in order to look closer to these things, we can't do it on today, because it goes into another fields, out of the fields of mathematics and into the fields of physics. That you have to, again, and this is why Lynn is so Riemannian, you have to have, it's in order to know whether something is really true or not, it's not enough to make a law that says it's true. You have to also physically prove it's, that it's valid in this physical universe we are part of. Now, based on this, and this is what Lynn says, then you can go into the universe and make these experiments, and there you will find universal physical principles, that is, principles that you can prove are like this in the universe, are like this, and they also are something that are efficient and exists throughout the universe. And Lynn, in a recent paper that kind of also was the setting for this conference, this a small paper, What is the Human Mind?, lays out that, well, we have such principles. Kepler, for instance, demonstrated one. Gravitation, or you can say universal gravitation, that everywhere you have gravitation, not as a mathematical formula like Newton puts it up, but as a physical principle. And this gravitation, because this gravitation is a universal physical principle, because no matter, so to speak, how small an area you dig into, this principle is still holding. You can say it's physically infinitesimal. That is, that no matter how small a thing you go into, you still have the gravitation. Then we have another principle that also we know are universal physical principle, that's life. Like proven through the biosphere, that we have this principle the principle of life as an efficient principle that intervenes and changes the universe in a very dramatic way, where it pops up. And then we also have another principle that are very dear to us, cognition. This is also a such a universal physical principle that you can prove exists, that you can prove. I mean, yes, cognition, you can't hear it, you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't touch it. But despite that, it's probably the most powerful physical force that we know to exist.
It hugs you from inside.
So it's we can't observe it with our senses, but we can prove its physical very, that it's a very efficient principle that changes the universe. And then Lynn says, of course, so our job is, and this is also, I asked this question yesterday on this, because he then says, our job is to discover new physical principles, both those that are presently there and those that will be created. And then I asked, what do you mean by that, Lynn? How are they created? Is it like the universe creates them, or is it us, human beings? Can we create new physical principles? I mean, it's a little bit like saying, you know, you learn in the school the natural laws, the laws of nature. You have gravitation, you have this, you have that, you have that. And if you then suddenly would say, oh, and then, by the way, then we have extra ones. These are to be discovered, and then we also have this section. That's the ones human beings will create. It sounds a little bit like a heresy.
Yeah.
To say human beings will be creating new physical principles. But that's actually what Lynn says. Not physical principles that goes against the laws of nature. But that the universe, just like the universe, is predisposed for life. If life comes, like we see it on Earth, then the universe says, great, let's help it. Everything is set into place so life can be efficient. Life has an advantage over non-life. It's unfair, but that's the way the universe works. Because the universe, or the creator, has decided that life is more important than non-life. That's the rules of the universe. And in the same way, when we appear, cognition, well, cognition has a built-in favor. The creator likes cognitive beings more than non-cognitive beings. That's the way it is. It's very unfair. But that's the way it is. So when we are cognitive, then the universe is predisposed to receive us well and help us out. And exactly in the same way, then the universe is predisposed for the coming into being of new universal physical principles, which are not directed against the universe, but which will help the universe to improve. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I should have asked a long time ago, but could you just explain exactly what cognition means?
Yeah. I mean, in Danish, we would say erkendelse.
Oh, self-awareness?
Self-awareness is part of the cognitive powers, but cognition is to be cognition. I mean, you can use it in on different levels, but basically, it is the unique human ability to be able to look behind sense impressions. That is, you get sense impressions, then you are able to establish the prince, you are able to ask why. I get these sense impressions, but these are just effects. Why do they happen? What is the cause of these things? And this animals are not able to do. They're able to respond to effects that hit them. And even being trained, like the famous experiment with Pavlov's dogs, you know, you can and you can train dog. You can ring a bell, and if every time you ring the bell, you present food to the dog, then after some time, when you ring the bell, the dog will come. So the dog is, and animals are able to have a certain cause of effect on a primitive basis. But a dog or an animal is not able to create a hypothesis about what are the reasons behind these effects that hit me, that observe. I mean, this, of course, this is a everybody should struggle with trying to come up with a better and refined idea in their mind of what is cognition really. What is it really that separates us so fundamentally from the animals here? Again, we can observe, it's an efficient principle, we can observe the effect, we can observe the fact that we are over 6 billion people on this planet, whereas if we did not have cognition, we might be 10 million. So there's no doubt that the cognition exists, but then we have to more and more refine our understanding of what is this cognition that we have, that animals don't have. Like any other thing, I mean, like you observe gravitation, that's great, but then it raises the question, what is gravitation, how does it work, and so on and so forth. The same thing with cognitive powers. Each of us have these cognitive powers. It doesn't mean we know how to use them. We just have it, it's like a tool. But because you have the potential of speaking, or the potential of walking, or the potential of doing things, it doesn't mean you know exactly how to do it. You have to refine this ability, and that means you have to refine your ability to use your cognitive powers. And part of, if you want to be a revolutionary, if you want to do something good here in the universe, then you have to refine that power. Then you have to become smarter. Then you have to willfully train yourself to become a genius. And that takes work. The cognitive powers, you're born with them, but they're not developed. They have to be trained.
Here's the wonderful thing with this, because as revolutionaries, because you said this revolutionaries, what is really fantastic is that when you work on it very hard, as Tom said, to really struggle with it and figure out more about the functioning of the universe and how you relate to it and so on, if you at the same time are having mankind and mankind's condition in your mind, then your capability for thinking and making breakthroughs becomes there. If you kind of try to sit someplace and just kind of work on it without relation to the rest of the world, it doesn't happen. And you know immediately when you shift to be part of the universe for action, for being a revolutionary, for caring for mankind, then your capability for making breakthroughs, it kind of just almost then comes on its own. It's a total other domain you're in, which I think Tom is going to talk about later.
I mean,
right? The one, the fourth.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no other way If you want to be there, then you have to be connected with doing good for mankind. Okay. But this is something that you never hear in school.
No?
Huh? Oh, yeah.
And you even have the case, for instance, you there's somebody asking you a question in an area where you're not so much at home, but you know a little bit about it. And then in order to answer this question, the person asks the questions, and you're so much committed to helping this person out that as you make the explanation, you will explain this matter in a better way than you yourself before had understood it. So you explain it, and then you say, wow, who was that talking? That sounded pretty smart. Let me note this down. No, seriously. And you would not have been able to do that if it had not been driven by this intention of helping out this other person. So cognition is not a dead cold thing. This is not a brain thing. This is very much connected with the will to want to make breakthroughs. Breakthroughs don't come by themselves. They only come if you really want to make them. And if you just want to make them for your own sake, then normally it's problematic.
So that means we have to have one more ingredient, and that's love.
That's love. Mm-hmm. And that's also, I mean, we've been using this word they had from Greek word that they also, the Christians, first Christians use of agape or kape. People say it differently. Agape, which was a special kind of love. I mean, you can have eros, they also had a lot of it. Erotic love, this is what you spend most of the time dealing with. But then they also have this other kind of love which they use for different things, like love of, you can say for love of truth, for justice, for a different kind of love, which is not based on immediate satisfaction of your bodily needs, but which is a different thing. It is a certain kind of satisfaction, in a certain sense. It's satisfaction of some spiritual needs you have for actually improving the world, for acting on behalf of mankind, for what's in some sense sacrificing yourself for a higher purpose, which in one sense is a sacrifice, in another sense is not really a sacrifice.
You get much more.
Because this gives you, this helps you move into an immortal existence. And it can definitely, if you are able to keep the right perspective, make you happy. That is, I mean, if you've seen Beethoven's opera Fidelio, I don't know, has anybody seen it? Those that have not should see it. Because, no, this is Florestan, who really was Lafayette, which was a American hero from the French, he was a young French nobleman that went to the United States
and became American.
Helped win the War of Liberation, and then came back to Europe, to France, as a intelligence agent for the Americans, and went around and studied things and tried, of course, to replicate what happened in the United States and Europe. So this opera by Beethoven is about in changed names and so, but Lafayette was put into jail to prevent him from doing this. He was put in an Austrian jail on orders from Pitt. Anyway, Florestan is sitting there in this very dark jail. He is almost dead. He has been starved, his terrible circumstances and this and that. And of course he's miserable. But then he thinks about why he's there. And he's there from the fact that he would not give in, that he did what he had to do to uphold what was true, what was right, to fight for justice. And then despite of his totally miserable circumstances, it's joyful. But again, it's a question of having the right perspective, because other people would complain about the fact that they have these miserable circumstances. So our job is to discover and create new valid universal physical principles, so we can actually improve the new sphere. But it's not just improving the new sphere, it's improving the universe. I mean, we don't know if there is other cognitive beings out there. For all that we know, it might be our job that we have to settle all of these galaxies that we see out there. As a matter of fact, we have to work from that standpoint. So we have a lot of work ahead of us.
We have many babies to make.
And we have many babies to make. 10 billion or 100 billion or 1,000 billion babies don't count much in this universe. There's a lot of work to do. But in this, I just want to say, I mean, one way of, we have this measuring rod again of the relative potential population density. How many people, not only how many, that's how many people can we feed at a certain level, but they also have to be produced, they also have to be developed, they have to be there physically. But one way I was thinking, the question is, what does Lin Min mean with this? How can you actually change, create new physical principles? And he says directly, well, one, the field where we are immediately confronted with this is the nuclear domain, is in nuclear physics. Already now, in our attempts to make, I mean, we know, we the sun, wherever it is out there, gives us light through fusion processes. That means that on the sun, mainly hydrogen particles melt together, fuse together to create helium and different things and produce light and energy, which is a tremendous of a lot of power, which heats us and the rest of the solar system, and we are very thankful for this. But the question, of course, is, can we replicate it here on Earth? Can we have fusion power? Can we have unlimited amounts of power available for mankind? Can we make it so that any person, anywhere in the world, has at his or her disposal all the energy you want? And thereby, the things, small problems like, do you have water, can be solved, because if you have energy, you can take salt water and purify it and create and transform it into fresh water. And we have lots of salt water on this planet. So if you have energy and if you have unlimited energy supplies, then it really means you can have a totally transformation in the living standard of people on this planet. So that would be nice to have. Already when we are making experiments on this on Earth and trying to recreate this fusion process here, we are creating things and creating conditions that might not have existed in this universe before. Because the way fusion functions in the stars is under different circumstances than what we try to create here on Earth. Among other things, the sun is a lot bigger than the Earth is. It's huge. I can't remember how much bigger than the Earth, but 330,000 times. Okay, so we're talking about pretty rough, huh? But it's quite a difference. So therefore, the difference, it has a lot of gravitation, and therefore that's one laboratory to make fusion in. When we have to make it on Earth, it's a different laboratory. We are not and different games and different principles has to be involved. So we already are probably creating temperatures here which are not on the sun in order to do this. So when we get by this, and as we get in, I mean, we've seen it, for instance, when we go into when we modify nature, when we improve nature, we actually change it. I mean, we create animals that are not really there naturally. I mean, we also have created animals that were not there naturally, but we also transform them. When we domesticate them, we improve them, we create, for instance, a Danish milk cow. I mean, this is a gigantic milk machine. No such thing exists in nature.
Or bacon pigs.
So we change the biology, and we improve the biology for our needs. Now the same thing will happen when we go into the nuclear field. This is just a very unknown, relative unknown territory for us. I mean, we should have been a lot more into it, but you've had this whole green ideology which says nuclear power is bad, anything with nuclear and so, stay away. But this is where we can make open up totally new world of science. We've called it, I won't go into it, we call it isotope economy, because it's not just unlimited amounts of power. It also means to begin to investigate how does these things actually function. I don't know how many of you have been studying chemistry, but in chemistry, for instance, and Vernadsky references this in his work, you have something called right-hand molecules and left-hand molecules. And this can be molecules with exactly the same same ingredients, exactly the same number of different
atoms,
but they're simply mirrored. And just like these two hands, you know, they're the same, but they're different. There's a right hand and a left hand. This you have in nature as a principle. So most, if you, for instance, have a living process producing molecules of some sort, when you look at it, it will be either right hand or left hand. But if you produce the same molecules in a laboratory, it will be 50-50. Now, in biology, it's probably for rocks, it's pretty irrelevant. With left and right, they don't care about these things. But in living organisms, this is a huge difference if it's the one or if it's the other. Some substances, then you'll have the, if it's right hand, then it's fine, it's great, it's healthy for you. If it's left hand, it'll kill you. It's a poison. So you have this principle. Now, if you go into the nuclear domain, you have isotopes. Every single element exists. Not only if you take, for instance, if you take carbon. What is carbon?
12, 13, and 14.
Then you have. I mean, carbon. It all of the carbon have six protons as a charge, but they have a different amount of neutrons. These atoms. And according to the number of neutrons, then you can have carbon 12, carbon 13, carbon 14. There's also others. Some there's a lot of, some there's less of. And when you then have molecules, say for instance you have medicine, you have an enzyme you use for something, then how this works probably depends on if it is carbon 12 or carbon 13 or carbon 14 at key places in this molecule. We just don't know it, because we never investigated the matter. Then you have the question of, if you go into the nuclear domain, are we going to see new also states of matter? This is also open questions, and so on and so forth. So it's like, so Lin opens the door and says, we have to discover new physical principles, but you should not forget who we are. We are not what the World Wildlife Foundation say we are. We are not animals. We're human beings. We have cognitive powers. And we, therefore, uniquely, we can create new physical principles on behalf of the universe that has to be here for its further development. But again, these things will not come about by studying your textbooks, because they don't exist. They will only come about if you make new hypotheses, make experiment, like Kepler was doing in his field. He was making a hypothesis about how is this organized with the planets. Then he tested it out. Then it turned out it was wrong. Then he made a new hypothesis. And even though 99% of all his hypotheses were dead wrong, he ended up with some very, very, very valuable results, because he understood that even though it's tough, even though you make mistakes, you learn from them. And the question is not so much if you get everything right the first time. The question is, are you able to, every time you make the mistakes, of improve what you're doing, so you can improve the process and again change what you're doing. In this, there is then, which Leni called for, we have then also the question. Now, we spoke about three domains. We spoke about the abiotic domain, the dead things, the biotic domain, or the biosphere of living organism, and then the third domain, we can call it, or the cognitive domain, the new sphere. And then, of course, comes this question, but is that it? Or where, for instance, when we human beings are creative, where does that come from? Is that something that just is here in the new sphere, and therefore we make use of it? And actually also, this question is related to something that is a very big problem we have, and that is the question of having insight. That is of we human beings, we are so drilled to live in the world of sense perception that even though we know it's wrong, we still tend to carry about the rules of sense perceptions with us all the time. And it very much dominates the way we think. Lynn has this.
It's
how do you attack? Lynn, in his paper, he says, those truly creative persons we call universal minds. I mean, and it can be scientists, it can be people like Lynn, composers like Beethoven, for instance, great scientists, great composers. They seemingly have something which most people don't have. It's like if they don't stand, and he also knows because he's one of them, within the known universe. They don't stand in this physical universe like we know it, but they stand in the real larger universe, where there is where other principles are dominating than those which determine, which simply is the physical effects you observe. I mean, he also calls it, because it's also a different problem, and we can go to the circle here. I'll jump it. What should be the order of events here? Always a big question. But you also, when we address, because we are very used to this concept of quantity, of more or less. This is what we learn very much in school. So you learn that 4 is more than 2, or 1,000 is more than 3, and this is bigger than that, and so on and so forth. But real interesting things in the universe is not a question of more or less. It's not a question of quantity, it's a question of quality. And we see it very directly in these, when we for instance compare the abiotic domain, the dead things, with the biotic domain of living things. When we look at a rock, or we look at a plant or an animal, the difference between the plant or the animal compared to the rock is not that it's more molecules or more of this or than the rock. It's simply a totally different kind of quality. Even you would say between the plant and the animal, it's not a question of more or less. It's a question of a different quality. If you took all the animal, all the rocks you could gather in the whole world and took it into one place, all of these rocks would not be able to do what one animal could do. They would simply lie there and be very boring. And the same thing we see between animals and human beings. I mean, if you took, again, all the animals of the whole world and put them in one place, out here in the hut, big hut, and say, please build the platonic solids. And you say, I'm very patient, take the time you need. It still wouldn't happen. So there's this difference in quality. And
even if the cats got to learn how to collaborate with the dogs, it wouldn't help.
It wouldn't help, no. And this is, again, it's a very old discussion. The Greeks were very much into this. And Kusa then, I have to take up Kusa, Pliny mentioned it yesterday, took it up as a way of trying to understand this principle with the problem of squaring the circle. And this was like a classical problem in Greek geometry. If you have a circle, could you then please make a square which has the same area? And the Greeks knew how to do a lot of things with geometry, as we know. They knew how to double the cube, which is pretty tough. This should be a pretty simple problem. And also, they worked out methods of doing this. That is, creating a square which create a square which has an area which is so similar to this circles that you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. What Kusa does is that he says, yes, but is that really so? Are you able to create a figure which has the same area as a circle? And then of course you could say, well, what we can do is we can, if you have a figure like a square, not really a good square,
it's not a good circle.
Then it doesn't really, but you understand the principle. There's something left over here. And you could even, no, we'll do it from the, and then you could say, aha, it's not a circle. But what could we do to make it a bit more like a circle? We could, you know, double the number of sides. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot better.
That's right.
It's a lot, lot better. And if you then imagine we would take double the number of sides again, you know, then at looks much more. And we, if we then have a computer, right, and we make this computer create circle for us, then we can actually see that if it's high resolution and so, we can actually get if we have 64, 128, say we have 10,000 sites in this polygon, would we be able to see the difference? Probably not. So if somebody came in and you says, and you would say, here we have a, what do you say, we have this on the one side, the circle, on the other side we have something, a 10,000 sided figure here, polygon, what do you say, is it the same? And he would say, yes, it's the same, looks like the same. But if we then would say, aha, but if we zoom in and look very closely, we take a microscope and we go into to a very small area, then we'll figure out when we zoom in to 1/10,000th, it has a corner. And as we go around, we can count 10,000 corners. So it looks like the same if you make a lot of these sides, but it is fundamentally different. And what Kusa then does is that he says also, well, and the point, and the funny thing is, if you say if you make all of these, if you have a polygon with 10,000 sides, the area gets a lot closer to the area of a circle, but the nature of the figure becomes more different, because at least, I mean, our circle has no side, it has one side it has no corners, whereas our square has four, the other one has 10,000. So in, as you move closer, you get further away, because it's a different quality. And then if you try to, you can then make experiment, you can say okay, it's a different quality, which is then the superior. I mean, it's like observing in nature. You observe, here we have dead material, you can, here we have living organisms, they're different, they're non-compatible, which one is then the superior? Or you could put it in, and what does it mean to be superior? Which one is more powerful in the universe? Which one can create more change? We want change. then you'll see that then comes the question, of course, can you, from the polygons or from linear lines at all, can you then create the circle? And vice versa, can you, from the circle, create the lines, and thereby also the polygons? And you did this yesterday, right?
Yes.
The day before yesterday. The thing is, most people, of course, would say, yeah, but it's easy. If you have a center, right, and you have a line, well, you have a compass.
It's okay.
You have a center, you have a compass, right? And then whoop, you rotate around it and you have a circle. So all you need is a point and a line, right? You get it from Euclid, and then you can get your circle. The problem is, it's not the point and the line that creates the circle, it's the rotation when you rotate it around. And if you don't rotate it, you don't get your circle. But as you know with this other, if you have a circle, you can bend the circle, it can you can rotate the circle, this is what you do when you bend it, and when you fold it, then you could actually create other things. So you have this quality of existence, you can say, between the circles and the polygon. And the same way you have this quality of existence, like we see it between living and non-living organisms. You can also say it another way, that if you have a circle, then you can actually transform it into something less. You can get a polygon out of it. If you have a polygon, you cannot have a circle. It's a little bit like if you have something living, then you can kill it, and it's dead. That's the easy part. To take something that's dead and bring it alive, you can't do. So it's this. So there is this qualitatively difference where in order to, it's easy to go from living to dead. It's easy to go from the circle to the polygons. It's impossible, just like that, to go the other way. Which then also creates a certain problem for us, because how is it then possible? If we have Earth, and we say everything is dead, it's abiotic, it's all rocks, how would it then be possible for life to come into being?
I don't understand the question, can you repeat it?
Say Earth is being created 4,700 years ago. You have the sun 4.7 billion years ago. You have the sun, and the sun begins to, it rotates and it spins off matter, and all of this matter it spins off begins to gather together in planets, and one of them is Earth, and after some time it cools off, and then you have planet Earth, a lot of dead matter. How then, where does life come from?
God, of course.
God?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how does he do it?
Yeah, that's a big question.
Huh? Right? Because it's a little bit like saying, if we take a lot of polygons and we mix them up and we make a random combination, then we might get a circle. Because life, yes, because life is not the molecules in a certain sense. Life is not the atoms. There's something more to it. I mean, it's like if you have something living, you can kill it, and everything might still be there, but it's dead, and you can't bring it back to life. Even though, I mean, you know, even though everything is there, it's a little bit like you have the figure is almost the same, but it's not the same. There's this qualitatively difference. It's kind of soul, yeah. And the same thing between man and between animal and man. We have not been here that long. Where do we then come from? Was it that suddenly there was an animal saying, I'm tired of being animal, now I want to be man? No, it cannot happen. Because you cannot, no matter how many animals you have, they don't just become men. And then deals with this. I mean, it's like he says, his expression of this is that there's something outside the third domain, the new sphere, where we exist. There's something outside there which determines the creation of all of these domains. A higher principle. I mean, you can call it creator, you can call it God, but giving it a name doesn't really explain everything for us. And then somehow processes like can be tuned in to be in accordance with, be receptive of this higher process out there, and thereby be able to be brought into life. There has to be this certain ability to be able to tune in, this is how he describes it, to this overall ordering principle in the universe, to this anti-entropy out there. Okay. Lynn is saying these things. It's not like that's necessary. It's questions. How is this? But one very, very, very important thing about this is that this idea of Kusa called this the transcendental. That there's certain things, and he also develops transcendental numbers, for instance. But the principle is here. That is that, for instance, if you have a number pi, right? If that is the relationship to the circle, which is the same thing here, between the diameter of the circle and the circumference of the circle. And everybody, and in the beginning in the school, then when you're a little student, they say, but that's 22nd sevenths. Or you get a number and you learn a number and you use it, and this is, it's very practical. But then, of course, they lied to you, because that's not what it is. There is no number that can describe this relationship. I mean, you can make 3.14, and then you can have 50,000 decimals, and you will always get new ones, because it's immeasurable. It's in a different nature. So this transcendental principle he then develops. I mean, transcendental, it means also, I guess, to transcend. It's like he uses it as this example, it's between man and God. God is like the circle. No matter how much we develop, we'll never be God. But we strive after becoming more like him. This idea is then something other people keep working on in trying to explain it. I won't go into it here, I think. But Lynn sometimes uses this expression of transfinite, which is an expression from Georg Cantor of how to have these orderings. Wait a minute.
Higher orderings.
Not this lower level.
Yes.
Maybe I can just give a short example on trying to get at this transcendental stuff, because it's not so easy. Some I think would say, well, if you have an infinite polygon,
yes,
it would become a circle.
Yes.
Right. And so, but if you think about it, if you take a polygon and you look at the corner of the polygon, you look at the angle, right? If the sides grows, what happens to the angle?
Spinner.
So what happens if you imagine that you have an infinite, you grow to an infinite, how do you say it? If you go towards an infinite number of size, how big, what's the angle going to go towards? How big can it get? What's the maximum?
Okay, I will not dwell so much with it, because I think I'll rush things here a little bit. I'll just say that if you stand in the world of the polygons, say, you know, one square met a pentagon, and the square says, "Hi, pentagon, how are you doing?" And the pentagon says, "I'm doing fine, but you know what? I went into the woods and saw a very strange phenomenon." "Oh, you did?" "Yes. I saw this thing, and it was a little bit like us, but it was not at all like us." "What do you mean?" "It had no sides." "Oh, is that really something to look at?" "Yes, because it was like more perfect than even the 27th egg, 27th polygon I saw over there." "Oh, but what do you mean then?" And anyway, the polygons would try to explain to each other what this circle was all about would always be negatively. You would say, "It's not that, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that." And through saying what it's not, you would try to explain what it is, because you cannot say what it is, because there's no expression for being a circle in the world of the polygons. And of course, it's the same thing if animal were trying to describe us as having cognition. It's like there's something they cannot get to. It's the same problem we have.
They do know we are special.
But they know we are special. They can observe that there's something there we don't have. And the same way we can also see that there's something that the universe and how the universe functions and the creator, you would say, or God, this is something that is outside us. It's something that bounds what we can see, what we can do. And we can try to picture elements of what it is not. But we cannot positively understand it, because it's beyond, in a certain sense. Beyond us. There's things out there we cannot grasp in its totality. I'll try to cut to the point here. The thing is, for instance, if you have like development on Earth, if you would say you have abiotic, somehow there has to be introduced a totally new principle that is not there in order to get life. Once life is there, life can develop. Life can change the abiotic. It can take over the whole planet. But there was a jump that is mysterious and cannot just be explained, going from the abiotic to the biotic. The same from having animals to having us human beings. It's inexplainable how that happened. Yes, you can explain that our biology looks pretty much like the chimpanzees, but it doesn't explain anything, because cognition is not biological. It's not in the body. It's somewhere else. So it's this non-linear leap. And it's actually the same kind of thing when we make creative discoveries. That we have certain things. We have this and this and this, and we're thinking about it, and what is it? And then we say, aha! And then we come up with a new idea which is not in what we had. It's like you have certain things, and then you create an idea, but the idea is more than the sum of its parts. All of the parts are in the idea, but there's something more. Where does that more come from? It could not come from the parts. It's like if we, you know, put a hand outside the third domain and pulled in something, which is, I think, how Lynn a little bit thinks of it. I mean, it's like you reach outside the third domain and you get somehow out there, And if the Christians, or the Muslims probably too, would say, but that's God. You know, you work hard and then God will help you. He'll give you the new idea. For other people, that's not a satisfactory explanation. Then you can say it's the fourth domain. You go out and pick it in from the fourth domain. But so we human beings, and this is also, then we are back to this with cognition, because we uniquely can do through cognition what the universe does as a principle. We have within cognition this anti-entropic principle. It's in us. I mean, we can willfully, like the universe willfully develops, it's willfully anti-entropic. That we cannot notice. We can in exactly the same way choose to be that. And when we do that, then we can willfully be creative. And we can willfully solve problems we stand in front of. But it's dependent also not so much on the ability, it's dependent on the will. Riemann describes this, he has this expression that when we make a scientific breakthrough, then it's like we have n dimensions, and then we move to n plus one dimension. Like, for instance, you can say we have dimensions, we have like space, three-dimensional space, and we have time, that's another dimension. Then we can discover a totally new principle, like magnetism. And you cannot describe this within the old geometry, so it's like it functions like a new dimension. And we have this ability, uniquely this ability. We are able to create, and when I say new dimension, it's not necessarily in space. It's a new physical principle that cannot be explained by the other physical principles we already know. And what we do, so to speak, as a part of what it means to be human, that is to make these discoveries, these leaps. And again, it is a leap, and because you cannot go from the polygon to the circle by taking a step. I mean, you can't. It's because you keep doubling, you begin to get tired and you ask, when do I get to the circle? It's right around the corner. But it's not. It looks like you're almost there. It's probably like Obama's presidential ambitions, you know. It's almost there. And everybody says, when do I get the nomination? It's almost there. And you won't get it, hopefully, because it's not meant to be. So you have to make a leap. You have, and how do you make a leap? And if at one point we'll go into the transfinite, and then it's more evident there, and that's why it's interesting. You have to stay outside the geometry you're presently in and make the jump. And we human being, we do it by in a certain way, that we are in a certain geometry, and then we decide there has to be change, and then we make a jump, and it's a jump into the unknown. So it's in one way unpleasant, because you don't know where you will land. But then you have to have a certain confidence that this is, after all, a very beautiful universe. And that if you make the jump, where you will land will be a better place. It's a different place. It's not going to be, and that's one of the problems, you are in a place where you have everything figured out. Then you have to make a jump, then you get in a new place where you have to work a little bit to master it, but that's the essence of being human, is to make these jumps, to make a leap, transform yourself, you could say. You're still the same, because you who you are should be identified with this constant change you're undergoing. But the problem is, if you decide not to change, then you get to be a big heavy blob which just sits there. And then this is important, because what in each such transformations into a higher order, you get to be more powerful. And you have more ability to do good. And it's like, it's not totally like that, but anyway, I think it's still a good metaphor. You go in to see a play. And this is a historic play taking place on stage. It's scaringly similar to what we see in the world today. Now, you're sitting there in the audience and observing this play. And you get into it, because you think this is really thrilling, and you emotionally it gets you going. And after some time, you when something happens, you know, you see the guy coming in, he's about to kill the good guy, and you begin to shout, "Stop! Stop! Do something!" And the fact that you do that does in some way influences the play that takes place on the stage. I mean, if the actors did not have an audience to play for, it would definitely they would perform in a different way. And when you say that, also this guy which comes in with a knife might even stop for a second when he hears the shout. But if you were an actor on stage, would you not be more in have more to say about how the outcome of the play would be? Surely so. Then you would much more be able to shape the events that took place on the stage. But as an actor, you still have to act according to the rules laid out by the director of the play. And the director of the play had set certain directions. This is what you do at this time, this is what you do at this time. So the actors have a certain freedom. They are very important for making this happen. But when push comes to shove, the director is much more powerful in determining the outcome of the play than the actors. But the director, at least if he is a competent one, doesn't simply direct the play according to his own whims and temporary passions. He actually has the play written by the playwright, and it's actually the play written by the playwright which determines the real outcome of the play. So you can say the playwright has a lot more to say about how this play ends than the director or the actors or the audience going to see the play. And then you could even say, yes, but you have this playwright, but what about the guy who is teaching the playwrights how to write the plays? Does he not have a greater power to influence what happens? So it's like an ordering principle where you have, it's not just a question, you go from one to the other. You go from the actor, from the audience, people in the audience, to the actors, to the director, to the playwright, to the educators, to the educator of playwright. And at each level you have a higher power mægtighed. This is expression also Kanda uses. It's a higher power to act and influence the events that take place. And therefore, it's also when you as a human being stands in front of you get involved in human affairs. I mean, the first thing you decide is, I'm here, I'm a human being, I want to do good. That's at least, that's how things started for me. And then you look around and you say, okay, where can I do some good? You know, there's a traditional old lady standing there by the side of the street waiting to be helped over to the other side. There's other problems in society that calls your attention and wants to be helped. And you're caught with the fact that you only have one physical life. There might be something later, who knows? There's no guarantee. The only thing you know is you only have this one mortal life. And it's like it's a one-time shot. And therefore you, it's first of all you have to choose, do I want to do good or do I want to do evil? That's a very fundamental question. But that's not the full answer. You also then have to say, okay, I want to do good. Where can I do the most amount of good? On what level do I want to use my powers to intervene? Do I want to be an actor on a stage with a pre-written play and let things play out and then taking the, you know, the praise for how well I played my role as it was written by these guys, by somebody? Or do you choose, do you say, I don't know how capable I am, I don't know, I have talents. I don't even know how far my talents can carry. So, do I then test that out by choosing the lowest level to intervene on? Or do I say, heck, why don't I try to be on the top? Why don't I intervene on the most powerful level where history is being made? Why don't I, so to speak, choose to be a circle in the world of polygons, or a human being in the world of of animals or whatever? But go for the highest level of saying, I have talents, I must train these talents, I must try the utmost to train my cognitive powers, but the cognitive powers is not alone. There's a certain human will I have to deal with. I have to train my emotions to also do this. I have to change. Not one time, but I actually have to train myself to put my identity not in something set, not in an apartment or a house or a job or this or that, but in the identity of a constant change, of constant improvement in the use of my cognitive powers, in my benefit to the universe, in my benefit in improving the universe. And since I don't know how far my talent will bring me, I have to push it to the utmost. I have to practice it, I have to train it, I have to see how far does this carry, how much good can it actually do in the world. And especially also with a special eye to the fact that timing is important, that there is a certain timing involved in the universe. It's not enough to come with, it's not enough if you have a hungry population that are on the level of starvation to come back the year after with a good harvest. It's too late. Even though it was a great harvest. You had to be in time. And that's the role we have in a certain sense. That's where we are. We have this unique capacity, this cognitive power, whatever it is. We have to figure it out exactly how it works. This power of having insight. I mean, again, what is an insight? Does it mean to look into something? No. An insight means that you are able to see something you cannot see with your eyes. That is to look behind the sense impressions and establish a deeper principle that creates what you see. Same when you can see through things. I can see through that. Does it mean it's just some something you can see through? No, it does not. It means that through your mind you're capable of not being manipulated by the sense impressions you have, but going beyond them and thereby letting your free will decide a different outcome than the manipulation you are about to be subject to. And how we spend this ability we have, and how we spend these talents we have, which are all different. I mean, we are all different human beings. We are all going to play, we all have the potential of playing a different, absolutely decisive role in how this universe will develop or will be destroyed in the time ahead. We decide how do we spend it, how do we develop it. And that will decide, are we going to get what is like pre-programmed, the autopilot of the world, of going into chaos and war, having the British finally get what they want, eradicate the United States, eradicate the principle of creativity from planet Earth, or will we instead, under the threat of this, give people a chance to be truly happy by setting off this spark we have and really being creative in creating a new renaissance, where, like Lynn very beautifully described it in the call yesterday, where we finally realize that there's not brown or black or yellow or green people, that it's all human beings and there's only one human race, that everybody, no matter what the color of their skin or eyes or hair, whatever, everybody are born with this potential for being a cognitive power in this universe, and being able to spend a life where you know that even if you might die tomorrow, your life was not in vain, because you have been able to contribute something that will live on also when you pass away. And this is where we are, and this is not academic, because decisions will have to be made already in the weeks and months ahead, which will be decisive. So, as I say, they have this Chinese proverb, right? Even the longest journey begins with the first step, and there might be a journey to make to be a genius like Lin. A long journey. But we have to dare to be wise and actually take that step. So, it's almost 1 o'clock. What's the plan? Is there a greater plan? Yes, we can talk. Yes. Yes.
Vi beslutter. Hvad der skal ske, ikke også?
Jeg tror, at det skal beslutte, hvad der
kommer ud af
det. Who said that the only constant is change?
Heraklit. Eller Heraklitus over det. Actually, I'm not sure. I'm looking forward to the presentation you'll give on him. No, but the thing is, the Greeks were having these considerations. They were thinking in a non-linear geometry. They were working on spherics. I mean, their whole their science was based on going outside and making astronomical observations, and it was all based on spherics, not on a flat surface with points and lines. And the problem with Euclid was that he came a lot later, and he took all the discoveries that has been made, and then he killed them. Then he put them into a deductive system where you go step by step by step without discovering anything, but all based on these rules that were set up in the beginning.
When was Euclid? Is this after Christ?
No. Before Christ. Sorry, Euclid.
Euclid is after. He's later.
I thought about.
It's not totally certain when he lived.
Well, where
did he? I think he lived after Christ.
But that's also disputed.
I don't know. I don't know if it's known.
But
see, you have these books of Euclid, but who Euclid was is, and it's not even in a certain sense it's not so much a person. It's like a rule book. It's like a form of something.
You know, a person who you can talk with it very well about that, or email or telephone, is Rihanna in Seattle. They actually did one time years ago, a group up there, they went through the actions of Euclid, mm-hmm. one after the other. And since Lynn talks about it all the time, instead mm-hmm. of saying, okay, he's bad, it could maybe, I'm not saying do it, but it might be fun at one point to kind of just, Tom brought up a few of them, mm-hmm. but just look at them to see, because, I mean, a lot of people have been fooled by that. So.
I mean, the one thing you can use it for is that in Euclid, then you at least in the beginning set up some axiom, postulates, definitions, even though it's all a little bit confused, because what is axioms and what is postulates and what is definition, and it's really all of them is axioms and postulates and definitions because they're not proven. But then you are not allowed to deviate from that. You then have to, in a rigorous way, always go back to what you took granted from the beginning. So at least you have rigor, because what you have in politics today is not rigor. I mean, and what most people have is definitely not rigor. I mean, they're simply, you know, scrambled eggs. You, in their mind, you'll have the same person. I mean, ask almost any Dane. And I'm afraid this is true. If you ask a majority of Jane, what is truly, really the biggest problem the world has,
mm-hmm.
then most of them will, if you give them the proper possibility, saying it's we're too many people. It's very great. Yes, it is. I'm just saying that you'll, anyway, I'm not. You don't necessarily have to make the experiment. I've spoken to many people who had this idea. When you really push them, they would say, yes, the biggest problem is we're too many people in the world. And then, of course, comes a lot of problem for that, with pollution and this and that, and wars and blah, blah, blah. Human beings are the problem. Then if you then ask them, but what about you? What is the most important thing you've done in your life? And if they have children, what will they say? I gave birth to my children. Most people think this is the most valuable contributions they made. But how can you have a mindset where on the one side you think the biggest problem we have is too many people, and at the same time, but the most valuable contribution I can make is to get some? Doesn't make sense. And most people think, people believe, doesn't make sense. It's not consistent. It's simply something they picked up from somewhere, and they change opinion much more often than Al Gore changes underwear.
Mm-hmm.
They just change, you know.
And it's not this power of change.
No, that's not.
And it's not real change. It's fake change. It's not
arbitrary change.
Exactly. It's just that you take one picture for the other, and one opinion for the other. What should my opinions be today? Let me look. It's like dressing. You, who am I going to be with today?
There's also this that most people don't think of men, and they think about, in a funny way, it's kind of paradoxical, because they think about men as outside of nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But men is part of nature.
But I wanted to say, so this with the axioms, though, with Euclid,
yeah.
People don't have that. So at least it's a beginning to be rigorous and be aware of it, that demand from yourself that it has to be consistency. That what I believe, I should truly believe. And then you can move down, and this is what Socrates, the Socratic method does, is to take what you believe and then begin to go down and say, well, where does this come from? What are the axioms? Because that then brings you to axioms, and once you have clarified what your axioms are, suddenly you can begin to have free will, because you can begin to change. You can say, but I don't agree with that axiom. I don't want to kill everybody. I like human beings when I think about it. And then you can change your axioms. But if you're not consistent, most people don't even have an idea that they have axioms, and they have no idea where they came from. And you're in the same problem with yourself. I mean, sometimes you get very emotional. Sometimes it can something you really like. I really like that. And why do you really like it? It might be something, you know, that you're ashamed of liking, but I really like it. Then you have to ask, why do I like it? Is there a good reason or a bad reason for it? Because maybe you just like it because it's part of your culture and it's really crap. And even though you really like it, you should cut it out because it's no good. And you'll have other things where there's something you need to do, but you're about to do it and you say, but I don't want to do it, I don't like it. And why don't you like it? And then you have to investigate. If it's something you think you should do and you don't want to do it, why don't you want to do that? There's some axioms there that you didn't decide. It's not like you picked them. You were born, you were raised in a culture, you're in a society, you get bombarded every day, so you're to a large extent a product of something you did not choose. And only by being conscious of these things can you have the freedom of choice. Else you're just an effect of something. And this is, again, most emphatically the difference between, I mean, against what is cognition? What's the difference between us and the animals? Animals are just a result of outside influences. Something happens, they react to it. Something else happens, they react to that. That's their life. Uniquely, man is capable of doing something else, of saying, I'm tired of simply jumping around reacting to crazy effects. I have a free will. I look into the future and decide where I want to get, and then let that decide what I do, not the pressures from one or from the other or from this emotion or from that emotion, because then I can't get anything done. There's no free will if I'm simply in the powers of emotions and influences from the outside. So true freedom cannot exist unless you have the inner strength to act and an inner substance. There's got to be some you. It cannot just be, you know, whatever comes by.
But no. They don't have creativity?
No, because cognition, I mean, cognition in the sense that we differentiate here, creation of the new sphere,
okay,
is uniquely something related to man.
Yeah.
other people, you know, I don't know what they, you might have textbooks where they play around with these things. But the truly interesting thing is what is it we have as human beings that they do not have? Because if, again, if you look at the DNA profile of a pig and a man, it's 98% or whatever the same.
With worms,
it's pretty much the same. So what's the difference? The difference is not in the biology. The difference is not in the DNA.
So what about going through Kruse's microcosm and macrocosm, also in connection with the Creator? Because that might.
You don't know it, lady.
No. It's Tom.
No, it's.
We can also just discuss that later.
Yes, mm-hmm. Let's discuss that.
That's
then.
Very beautiful. Because also what you said with the Creator. Yeah.
I mean, it's a very relevant question to also, I mean, in religion, but you have this very important thing in the first book of Genesis, where you have this description of the creation, which end up with saying that in the end God created man in his image. As man and woman did he created them.
No, because
you don't have that book of Genesis. You have a different one.
Yeah, I have a different one. Because if you were an image of God, and you would be like perfect.
No.
We should be perfect. Why not? Because we if we are the image of God, then we should have. The elements and the characteristics that God has, and we don't have them. That's why in my book there is a lot, not my book but in Quran,
mm-hmm.
it's in the 112th chapter, it says that the God is one, the God is eternal, and he has not been born or and he hadn't given birth, and nothing is alike.
Yeah, but see the question is then, because I don't know, I'm sure in Quran, I don't know how they express it, but they probably have this somehow, I guess, I presume, I'm sure they have.
Yeah, I
see. So the point is, I'm not quoting this as an authority. I'm not saying because it's in the first book of Genesis, it's true.
Yeah.
That's first book of Genesis is not a physical experiment, okay? So it doesn't have power in a scientific sense. The question, I raised it for a different reason. I raised it when this is said, when man is created in the image of God, it does not mean that man is God, okay?
Yeah.
That's not what it means. The question is, What does it then mean to be in the image of God? How, if we are, it's in different, I mean in English you can also see man is created in his likeness. What does it mean to be, in what sense are we like God? Is it because we have two eyes? Is it because we have a mouth? Is it because we have 10 fingers?
I understand what you're saying.
Right?
You're saying that God is good and we have his like therefore, we should be good.
Mm.
And then
but it's more than that. It's like, because we are created in God's image, animals are not. It's not just the question of, because man is not, not all men are good.
Mm.
So it's this other capacity we have.
Yeah, but that capacity is not necessarily the image of God that we have.
No, it being in the image of God, it means that we have in some way a likeness with God that animals do not have. which gives us, because we have this likeness with God in this specific sense, not that we are like God in all senses, because we are not. God is perfect, we are not.
Yeah.
Okay? But in this specific way, we are in the likeness of God. And what we have to do is to identify what is that, because that is what we have to increase, that's what we have to train, that and you can be very specific. It is our cognitive powers, it's our capacity for reason, it might also be our capacity for love, there might be other things in it, huh? Not cold reason, but you could say the same kind of love God has, or the Creator has, that meant that He created this beautiful universe with all things in it. The same kind of love we also have in a much more imperfect, smaller scale, which makes us capable and us gives us a drive to go out and be creative and multiply, subdue the earth and do something good with the world,
but
improve the universe.
What you're talking about is, I see it more like a gift that we have. Because, like other creatures that are not on this earth, like angels, they are perfect, but they are also not in the image of God. And they don't have the same cognitive thinking that we have, for example. And that's why there is different creatures and creations around the world, but they are not like God in any sense. They are just,
you know, this whole issue, when it comes to religion, I always say step back, separate yourself a little bit from what you, because what I am a Christian and I believe of God and angels and all that, but come to think of it, who decided how angels look like? Who decided what powers angels have and don't have? Who decided what powers God has and doesn't have? Who decided, you know, there are so many questions that we just accept certain things that they are there. How those assumptions came to be, we have no idea. Like what's written in the Quran, that God is perfect and human beings, we are not like Him and all that. Who decided that?
God.
Why not man?
We are created.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there are so many unanswered questions. So I always say, don't impose what you know from your religion or something on certain other things that you want to think about. Sometimes the only way that you can actually be free-minded enough to think or reason through certain things is to step away from your religion or step away from certain basic beliefs that you have. Otherwise, everything else becomes clouded. Because, for instance, if this was a debate or an argument or something, I could debate and try to squash everything else that you say based on what I believe.
Yeah,
in the same way, you also try to squash everything I say based on what you believe. But that's not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you always, like I said, you always step back a little. See, okay, what if, let's put everything that I believe aside, what if there's something else there that I can think about? And for me, that is the way I choose to look at it. Then, because otherwise, then the issue of God and man, and to what extent are we like God? To what extent are we not like God? Because if we are not in any way like God, because we are not perfect, then what are we? Why did God create us in the first place? What are we? If we believe that God created us, then what are we? Because we are not like Him. What are we like? So the questions become enormous. And my view, at least, is if you really want to be able to think about things outside what you believe, then you have to step away from what you believe a little bit. That doesn't mean that you stop believing what you believe, but you step away from it so you can think about something else.
Yes. And it's also the case that any I mean, this is what it means to make hypotheses. I mean, you're faced with something and you investigate it, and then you say, could it be like this? Could it be like this? It doesn't mean you know it's like that, but you make hypotheses, you investigate, you try to understand, and then you test what will the consequences be of this hypothesis, of that hypothesis. I mean, it's like most people getting into contact with our campaign. You know, they meet these people, they are very dedicated, they are very hard working, you can feel this, they're fighting for something, and they seem to be pretty nice people actually. So maybe they're fighting for something, right? Then you begin talking with these people, and everything that you have learned, this is how it is, they say it's not like that. Almost never matter what, you know, they'll come and say, oh, but I also like to do things, so let's do something about global warming. No, there's not any global warming. What do you mean? But then let's do this. I mean, you know, let's go out and get some ecological food together and improve the world. No, it doesn't work like that. Or you take almost any issue today, but then let's go protest against, you know, the Chinese beating up the people in Tibet. Or no, okay, but then at least let's go against Mugabe. Or almost anything that you would think based on the popular belief in the media today, we will say it's not like that. And if it's like that, it's just a fluke, but you think it for the wrong reasons. So what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to say, I met these people, they have these very different beliefs, but they're very passionate about it, so therefore I just believe that instead of what I believed before?
I like to be passionate too.
Exactly. You can't do that. You have to say, these people say these things, but when I discuss it with them, seemingly they don't just say it to say it. So I'll investigate the matter. But for now, I believe what I believe, but I have that as one hypothesis, or this is what I inherited from my school or from the media. Now, we'll just for the sake of experiment, I'll try to think the way they now say. I'll try to look at the world from that standpoint. I'll try to investigate the world from that standpoint. And it's only when you then find out that when you investigate the world from the standpoint how LaRouche presented, that you seemingly better are able to understand the world and what goes on. Then you can say, hey, with LaRouche's method, then suddenly I can understand what's going on. With the media method, I don't understand anything. Seemingly, it's not perfect what LaRouche says, but at least it's a lot better than what I get from the media. And LaRouche then, of course, also over time, you discover new things. But so you should not simply throw away one rotten belief and take the first next belief that comes around. That's a very bad policy. You have to know what you're doing. So you should be willing to throw away things you believe in if you find out they're wrong. But you should do investigation. You have to do the work, because then you also know things from the inside. It's not just an adopted opinion. And that's why it's important to work with also science and scientific principles. Because if you work through the Platonic solids, then you know there's only five Platonic solids. It's not something you read in a textbook. You know it, and the process of finding out makes you know something, and this, in the same way, you have to get into the habit of actually yourself working through discoveries, because if you make the discovery yourself, then it's there, it's yours, it's for keeps. It's not something because you read it in a book, even a very or whatever, or a good friend told it to you or whatever. Did you want to say something, or are you just stretching?
No, I'm just thinking. I have to admit, I haven't really read Kruse, but he's also writing about faith, right? Because
because you can't scientifically so far explain everything in the universe. So what about the issue of faith? This is a big thing, I think.
I think Lynn had, and those that did not see Lynn's webcast should see it on this question.
Mm-hmm.
Because he addresses this in terms of, because in the US you really have a problem with a lot of people being controlled by their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And
the Danes too, it just looks not so controlled,
yeah.
But then
yeah.
They're actually as controlled.
Can you say you can have blind faith?
Sure, and the point is, what is faith? Some people have this idea, oh, but if I have the right faith, then I will get some reward. And the reward might not be in this life, but then at least I will get a reward in the next life, you know? And if I have to suffer for my faith here, this was very common in history to think like this, if I have to suffer for my faith here, that's of course very nasty, but it's like a payment on an insurance police, you know. Then later when I die, then I'm being rewarded.
But isn't like the same like what are you thinking? Like we are speaking one matter, like our ideas, and if we are being suffered for them, even if we are speaking truth, and then if we die of suffering, our ideas will live on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we will die, right?
Yes.
The same space you are.
Yeah, but
there's.
But see, there's a lot of people that are very fixated on life after death as being their personal, physically reward for having life. Like if you could not have the love you wanted in this life, then you get maybe 10 wives in the next life. Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds. I mean, you want a physical reward for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's problematic because faith can also be something else. Faith can be that you say, God, please give me the strength to do what I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do what you have to do, and you are happy because you're doing something which forever changes a lot of people's life for the better.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you die, it's not like you want to die because you want to live a long life and be fruitful and do things. But if that means that you die, you don't die in vain.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing you can do is what we do, for instance, with sending soldiers to Iraq or to Afghanistan right now, because you send people out to die and they die for nothing. That's the worst you can do.
They die for worse than nothing.
Or they might die for worse for nothing, worse than nothing, exactly. And therefore throughout history it comes to points where you have to be willing to risk your life. It doesn't mean you want to commit suicide, but it means that what the principles you're fighting for are so important that even if it comes to that, then that's not dying in vain. That's preserving these principles for the generations to come. And we can sit here in Denmark because, despite the fact that during, for instance, World War II, when Denmark was occupied by Nazism, most people simply collaborated because that was the easiest thing to do. There was young people that said, no, I know it's easier to collaborate, I know in one sense it's stupid to fight because most likely we might not succeed, we're going to get punished for it, I should do my studies, I might not get the career. But the fact that they stood up for these principles made it possible for something to come after. And if there had not been this moral, if we did not have people of that caliber, young people taking that fight, we wouldn't be here today. Denmark would not exist as a nation, I'm totally sure. It would long have disappeared. We would have been so ashamed of ourselves that we wouldn't even I wouldn't even be it.
The same thing is with faith. When you are believing in something, like if you believe in God and Creator, and
Yes.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
But even,
that's the point.
But even if you don't believe that, Tom pointed out you can get there anyway. You are not a Muslim now. Just think about yourself that you're Japanese and you are Shinto Buddhist.
Okay.
Believing in several gods. And you meet, now this is a real story, which kind of really proves what Tom says, because we have Buddhists, we have people that came as Shinto Buddhists, Christians, Muslims, Jews, and people that don't believe anything. And as Tom said, you have everything we say, everything is out there, we say something different. And then you begin to look at it, and you figure out, wow, if you begin to think about it the way that LaRouche thinks about it, then things hang together, and you begin to see your own power, that you can change things. Things are lawful, where everything else is not lawful. And then you begin to work on it, because there's an innate thing in every one of us, every baby, whether you're born in Asia, Africa, on Greenland, or wherever, there's an innate quality of man to try to figure out the causes for things and why things are the way they are. Why are they all kind of lawful, ordered? You know, little kids, just the way a flower is ordered and everything, it means there's something bigger, but people don't know what it is. And we have this young member in U.S. who was a Shinto Buddhist. And it took a long time because I was an older person. He couldn't look me in the eye. He couldn't talk with me. I had to go and listen at the door and he talked with the other youth to figure out how he was thinking. And finally we could begin to talk, mostly if he was driving, because then he didn't have to look at me. I did all kinds of things. And one of the problems he was fighting with was that we believe in the principle of one creator. And so he was fighting with doing what Tom was saying. And it really made sense to him, the causality, and he could figure out in his own mind that the laws that was going in his mind seemed to somehow correspond to the universe. And he said, I struggled with this lady for a long time now, this thing about one creator. And you guys always talk about your creator, or God, or Jesus, or whatever it can be. And I really couldn't take that. But then all these other things made sense. So therefore, from what Stephen said, if you take it back and you just put yourself in the shoes of everybody, a Shinto Buddhist, a what it now can be, and just begin really on your own as a person to investigate the causality of things and see how your own mind is functioning when you begin to discover things, like we did from wherever we come from, out in the woods, hunting and gathering and so forth, and man began to more and more take over the universe. And then it doesn't really matter if that steps in, whether you are a Muslim or a Christian or a Buddhist.
I'm not fighting him.
I know you're not. I mean, it's just that.
Or what you said.
It's really not so. It's not really the essence.
But this is a beauty of all thing, like what we are studying and looking at the universe and trying to figure out how things work. And this is really a beauty that I see, also like what creator have done. But now when we were discussing, I was not fighting what he said or what he was standing for, but I'm just giving him another view of point. That if there's not just only one way, that if you are saying to me from LaRouche's point of view, then that's it. But I have also my own view. Like from my belief, but I can take it from LaRouche's view, and also he can maybe look from my point of view. And,
but you can also be a Muslim and work with LaRouche's ideas.
Yeah,
there's no contradiction.
Exactly.
I think that's what he's trying to get at. You know, he's trying to find out how the science of Christian or Muslim or whatever economy works out. It is not a contradiction, and he has a lot of ideas. He's trying to relate to what we're doing.
Because the thing is that this religion, you know, most people have the religion because it comes from the parents. And this is what they've grown up with, this is what they believe in. But what we have to make sure to do is that each of us is responsible that the next generations have a future. If we are believers or not believers or whatever we are, if we don't master science, you know, we go maybe down, you know, we grave, you know, put into grave as a Muslim or whatever, but we are not anything because we didn't do our job.
You see, I look at things this way. The fact that you have this kind of collision of you know, what you believe and what you think or how you think it, it's also part of what makes you a human being. It's also part of what makes you a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Your ability to deal with that kind of collision of ideas or thoughts. Because someone like me, I could have chosen to be anything other than being a Christian. And he knows that because we've been talking about it. I've read almost half of the Quran because in my house there's always a Quran. Even though my parents are straight Christians, my grandparents have been straight Christians, but they always have a Quran in the house. And I have had to read about other religions or something of that sort. So I could have chosen to be any of those other religions because reading more about them brings a lot of things about life that are in sharp contrast to what I have believed in growing up. But then your ability to see how the different things work together and your ability to make a choice and say, okay, I have this, I have that. Which side do I stand on? Which one do I choose to work with? And to what extent do I work with them? So it's for me, it's perfectly fine to have those kind of, if you like, contrasting views of things, as long as you know how to deal with them.
Yeah.
Because if you don't master the ability to deal with them, then you throw your whole ability to think out of range. But if you know how to handle the conflicts that appear in your mind because of one body of thought and another body of thought, then that really makes you a higher, if you like, much of a higher animal than you previously were, because you are always changing and improving your ability to think and the way you look at life.
And we have to do that. I mean, we are the unique power right now as a movement that are in the process of bringing about a global collaboration between many different cultures around the world, many different religions, also many different countries which might have had a history of being in war against each other for hundreds of years. So you have all of that. And our job, and the job we uniquely can make, I mean, other people can bring people together. I mean, the British are excellent in bringing different people together. The problem is what comes out of it is very bad, because it's all with the British axioms. And this is an old problem we have, that the British have always been very aware of sitting on foreign policy. In almost any country, it will be British or British allied circles. They immediately take care of the foreign policy, the collaborations with other countries, often through in the country's noble families and so on that have a tradition for it, have control over that. What we have done very uniquely as a political movement, and already have transformed the politics of this planet many times over through that, is that LaRouche always have gone into the international scene and redefined these international relationships and opened up the possibility, presenting again new creative ideas that simply people who used to be enemies, then comes LaRouche with this idea of the Eurasian land, which says, why don't we do that? And suddenly you have all of these different enemies sitting together and saying, gee, I can't afford being enemy with him anymore, because if we don't get the railroad and this infrastructure through them, then it won't work. So it's not like you forget what was, but you simply say, instead of letting the past problems determine what will happen, we let the future determine what will happen. And we want a future for our country. And in order for us to have a future, instead of hate, instead of, so to speak, in a certain sense, attacking others for being different, then you try to understand what's really going on, and this you can do through understanding these things. What is cognition? How does this universe function? How do our mind function? So you can understand these other cultures, and therefore also can function from this idea of the benefit of the other. How I'm helping others and my neighbor nations, and this we all prosper from in the long run. So as a movement, we have this, especially this, we cannot be without this.
Makes us more rich.
Exactly. And we also have to have the insight and this will become much more. I mean, this is one of the fascinating thing we have with this, with this Kato school also, that we, the fact that we, that we are not just a movement of blonde, blue-eyed Danes sitting around
smiling
and being happy for Denmark is the most beautiful place in the world, blah blah blah. But the fact that we are an international movement, and that we have people from Africa and from South America and from Asia, and this is what this movement is all about. It's an international movement, and it's the international movement for setting up the framework, a new global order, where all of the nations and all of the civilization can actually prosper. So it's, and then we, every time I get this, and I do get this, this I feel pressured from the universe and from world events. I feel, do I really have to do this? It's a little bit like Hamlet sometimes, you know, you have this thought, couldn't I have been born on a different time? But then you can also look at it in a different way. I mean, we are standing at, right now, at the most important time in modern history. What happens, or what does not happen right now, will have dramatic effects for a long time to come. And that it's a great privilege to be alive in such a time and have a chance of doing something. Working with a guy like Lin, because he's not going to be here forever. And then instead of sitting around saying, what are we going to do when he's gone? that's not the point. The point is, what are we going to do while he's alive? Because while he's alive, we can do things we simply can't do when he's gone. So let's use the opportunity, this time we have when he's here, to set up this global order, because it's now we can do it. And then we should just be very happy that we are not some Chinese born in somewhere in the inland of China under some kind of dynasty, which has decided there will be no change for the next 500 years. And then you say, if I had been born 500 years from now, there might have been something interesting. But because I'm born at this other time, I have to go around and do like my father and my grandfather and like his father before did. That's nightmare. Being in a world like today, where things are very confusing, they're very demanding us, we have to develop very quickly, we have to take great responsibility,
well then
that's a unique opportunity.
We begin a new just world economic order, and we begin to really create a pathway for a beautiful future for the generations to come. Then you get another problem when you get old. You know what that is? You would wish that you would live for another 200 years. Benjamin Franklin, he was so upset because he could begin to see that things were really going in the right way, and he really wanted to then live in the future. Anyway, I'm just kidding.
But that's another, I mean, if we go into this sub-nuclear domain, I mean, we have a lot of things we want to master. We want to, right now, we have a very, very shallow understanding on what is life. It's like, it's very primitive. And if we just could get a little more grip on how does living processes functions and why do we does this work, it might actually mean that we can put on another 20, 30, 50 years of life in a fairly, I mean, healthy condition. And that's important because it's like if if you put like for instance LaRouche, LaRouche had very severe heart problems quite some years, it's actually quite some years ago, when was this, maybe 10-15 years ago now,
when I was around
10 years ago, he got severe heart problems, and if he had not gotten a bypass he would have died. It's that simple. And that would be it. And you could say, oh, LaRouche, but he got to be 75 years of age. That's a good, nice, long life, right? He got to do a lot. He was really creative. He really contributed. But the fact that through modern medicine, that we were able to prolong Lin's life is something, it's a gift that is so great you almost cannot imagine it. Because it's not the same. 10 years... extra for LaRouche with everything he has done up till now, and he can continue contributing based on what he has already done. I mean, if he was lying around doing nothing it wouldn't matter, but he's not, because what he can do is different from what anybody else can do, because he can build on everything he has done up until now. It's a little bit like saying, what would you give for Beethoven having lived another 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
Or Schiller. It's like, or Schubert, how old did he get to be? 28? What would you give for giving him another 10 years?
Hmm.
Because and this is the challenge for us. I mean really, and we don't know how long time we have. We could be run over by a truck tomorrow. So let's not say, oh, I'm young, so say when I get 50 years, 40 years old or 50 years old, then I'll really begin to do something. And the other thing is, once you actually once you dive in, once you get over the first fear and actually, instead of thinking about doing things, do them, it's actually not the nightmare you imagined, it's actually quite fun. Yes.
No, because once
we're going into the political action here, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, because once.
Should I can?
You know, because I want to make a point.
Yes, make the point.
Yes. No, but one thing which is for sure is that LaRouche is so special because he's fighting, and he's fighting since he's 12 years old. And he's fighting, you know, in the last 40 years, the politics very, very intense. And what makes him really special is that he always takes new challenges. Say, okay, where's a new plank? Because see, there's one very specific characteristic in Lin, which is in everybody potentially. It is the question of what do you do for others? Because we have a culture where, oh, everything is fixated on oneself. Yeah, on me, and, you know, one's sexual life, one's, you know, everything is affected on me, satisfaction for my. And this is everywhere in the culture, especially in the West, because this is where people have the luxury to think about themselves. But this characteristic that you put yourself on the spot and say, what do I do for mankind as a whole? If you don't do that, you're going actually, you're not going to use your potential for mankind as a whole. And I just say, like, straightforward, because it's not one thing that you do. You say, okay, I'm deciding how to fight. It's something you do all the time, even in the fight. you have to decide, okay, you might make a new step. It's this continuous change or this continuous demand from yourself to be bigger than you are, which is what people run away from. I mean, and it's really, it's not that other, it's really what keeps them down to act for mankind as a whole. So, yeah, stop that. Just be a free human being and act, okay? Okay, so therefore I would really ask people to begin to act for, yeah, in this direction, to help us in the speak of action here in Copenhagen, because we're going to have a marathon on mastering Kepler and a marathon on actually getting into political activity, in political fight. So we're going to have also, yeah, a lot to do, but we want also to have to get people a chance to dig into Kepler, because because you are not going to appreciate LaRouche if you don't begin to work to take the challenge he's taking up. He's actually demanding from you guys, from everybody, to really master the science work. You know, because, yeah, so this is a very crucial aspect. And therefore we are going to have this week of action. We need people to help out. And then we're going to have actually an election in Dresden. Now, when was it? When is the election in Dresden?
Election in Dresden?
Yeah, the
election.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm
not sure which
is the last weekend of May.
Yeah, because, you know, come to Copenhagen and then continue to Dresden. Because this is where Bethel is going to take part. We have one of our youth members, Markus Kürt, who is one of our potential Keplers. On the Kepler on the way. He's working very much on Kepler. But he's running for mayor. He's putting himself on the spot, actually. He's running for mayor and you want him to win this election. So I would encourage people to really, you know, take the challenge, help out in this week of action and go to Dresden for the rest of the month, and after that we have other flanks to grab. Because this is an international youth movement, and this is a LaRouche youth movement, needs really, you know, to grow in quantity but in quality especially. And I really mean this, Ikman, don't be afraid. Just jump into the cold water.
Take life in big bites.
You want to say more?
Yeah, the specifics are... Yeah, actually... Who's going to join us this week? Okay. Okay, sorry, enough.
We have, I mean, we're going to be out this week. Peter will stay this week, and we'll have a squad.
Joseph is coming out Wednesday.
Yes.
Yes.
What time?
Huh?
What time?
Ferita will give you a call.
Yeah. As much.
I would like to know. Before I come in here, my chef told me I will come in Wednesday working in Mike 2. You know, I have to start in Wednesday. I have to start in 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock. But if I have to come in work again Wednesday...
But you simply... It's like you say, okay, it is this that a journey begins with the first step. So therefore you sit down and say, okay, I can join there and there, then I can be part of the action, whatever it is, and then you begin there. You can't, I mean, you
but
might
Wednesday, if I have to work in the night, it will be 10 o'clock in the night.
Yes, and then we might be Thursday. We'll see, we'll figure it out.
Ask what time?
Yes.
It's the daytime.
We'll make
it's
plans.
It's the whole day. So the thing is, it's the whole week. And the details you get tonight, later tomorrow morning, but tonight. But the thing is that there's something going on the whole time. So this is the point. You know, okay, you're working then there, but doesn't matter, the other time, come for the rest of the day.
I mean, it's like, instead of saying we've had a very nice cattle school, wow, here we could enjoy ideas and all of this for a couple of days, but now that's over, now we have to go back to terrible times and boring life and all this others. The idea is, how can we create the circumstances where we can, I mean, where we can do that as much as possible, where we spend as much of our time as possible on changing the universe to the better, on improving our understanding on it. That's the challenge. I mean, it's a little bit like I, to a certain degree, think it's very helpful, instead of thinking of paradise and hell as something, you know, that happens after life, then thinking about it, that this is actually also a question of how do you live your life here on earth. Do you want to be in paradise, or do you want to be in hell? If you want to be in hell, spend all your time going to rock concerts, doing, you know, insane things, see how you can destroy your life and the others as much as possible.
How many physical pleasures you can get.
And they'll get very painful in time when you have to experiment through. Instead, you say, no, I want to be in paradise. I want to be as close to the creator and the creative things here in the universe as possible. That's where I want to be. Socrates, who made many jokes about this, I mean, his approach to it was, well, they say we're going to have a life after death where we're going to do all of these things. I'm going to meet so many beautiful and smart people when I die, but I better practice here in life getting some knowledge on how things are, so I can have some interesting discussion with them. So you have to basically, I mean, we want a renaissance. Mm-hmm. We don't want a new dark age. We want a renaissance. How do you get a renaissance? You live one. It's not something you work towards and then you sell tickets. You live it. You make sure that as much as your time as possible, you can use your cognitive powers and minimize, you know, crazy stuff. And you try to surround yourself with beauty. And you try to get a social interaction with your fellow fighters based on this idea that we wanna be a renaissance. So, and now we have this week a little bit special. Normally we complain we are all alone, so few. Mm-hmm. Now we can be a little bit more, so it'll be much more exciting. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and we have 20,000 newspapers to read.
And we have 20,000 newspapers, yeah, also to get out. Yes. Yeah. And then, as we discussed last night, we then now have a crash program to make a new one, and this has to be a kick in the balls for the British, because they are they need to be put in their place.
Do they have balls?
It's a very good question.
I guess that's why some people call it nuts.
They might not have balls, but for sure they are nuts. Okay, should we?
Yeah. Okay, but this, if anybody's hungry, there's food.
Thank you.
Eat it all up.
Yeah. Eat
it all up.
And,
I'm hungry.
And stay here for the week of action, everybody of you.
In this town?
Oh, this town doesn't have much action.
No. Sure. Well, it had this weekend.
Yeah. 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 Yeah